to Battle Royale, where we pass judgment on all of the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme, and who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
And I did the intro correctly that time. Did it with a bit of pizzazz and flair, I think.
Yeah, your tone was a bit different than usual.
Bit different. All right, so today we are doing
Louis the Ninth. I don't know why I really wanted to say seventh then, and I have no idea.
Yeah, when we were doing Louis the Eighth, I kept wanting to say Louis the Seventh because seven and eight in Roman numerals look really similar. It's only one eye off. So since we already covered the first half of Louis's reign during Blanche of Castile's episode, we're going to skim over a lot of the early stuff in his life. So this was going to be a two-parter, but I think because of Blanche, we can like squeeze all of the essential information into a single episode. Yeah. It's going to be a long one, but we can squeeze it.
For
a bit of a recap, let's go way back. Bit of a quiz for you, Eliza. Who was Louis the Ninth's grandfather on his father's side? Think about it. We did a two-parter on him. Louis the Seventh's son.
Who's Louis the Eighth?
He's not a Louis.
What?
He's not called Louis.
Philip the Second.
Yes, Philip the Second. Yeah. It goes Louis, Philip, Louis, Louis. Philip Augustus, what did he do?
He had all that shenanigans with Rich.
Yes. So they went on the Third Crusade together. And when they got back and after Richard died, Philip took down the Angevin Empire, which was under King John, and he expanded the French royal domain into Western and Central France from just the little island around Paris. And Louis the Ninth was born during his grandfather Philip's reign on the 25th of April 1214 at the Palace of Poissy. And Grandpa doted on little Louis.
Yeah, you know, strict on your son, but dote on your grandkids.
Exactly. And who was Louis the Ninth's father? Slightly easier question.
Louis the Eighth.
Yes, Louis the Eighth. Husband of Blanche of Castile. Who, Louis the Eighth, what did he do?
Oh, he tried to take over England, but it didn't happen.
It didn't happen for him. He did pretty much end the Albigensian Crusade down south, though.
And so him and Blanche had a very harmonious marriage and had lots of bubs.
Lots of bubs. The most bubs out of any
the most bubs
king of, that we'll ever have, which was eight bubs, to be precise.
Yeah.
Eight surviving bubs. And one of these was Louis the Eighth.
You mean Louis the Ninth?
Sorry, Louis the Ninth.
I was like, how's he getting better himself?
I promise that won't happen. Hopefully it's not another Philip Richard situation.
I know.
Louis the Ninth became heir when he was about 4 years old. He had an older brother, Philip, who died, and he also had two other brothers who died in infancy. So luckily they had lots of spares.
But they had what? It was like, she had what? It was like, was it 15, 16 pregnancies or something?
13 children born overall. And Louis the Ninth has three younger brothers who survive. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
And we'll see if they survive this episode. And of course, who is Louis the Ninth's mother? Subject
Blanche
of last episode.
Castile.
Blanche of Castile. Blanche. And she quickly took power in his name when his father died and Louis was 12, but not without being challenged. So there were many lords who challenged her. Mm-hmm. Don't know if you can name any of them.
Oh, I know who's on her side. Tybalt was on her side, right?
Yeah, Tybalt was on her side. He ends up becoming the King of Navarre. So that's Tybalt of Champagne. But the opponents, there was Uncle Herpel.
Herpel.
Philip the Count of Boulogne, also called Philip Herpel, or Philip the Skinhead. Then there was also Peter of Brittany, who's helping England try to invade. Yeah, the Duke of Burgundy showed a bit of discontent. Various shenanigans, but Blanche resolved them all, led some armies.
Like a boss queen.
Did some bossing.
Yeah.
Also from Tybalt, she managed to expand the royal domain to get some of the Blois lands. So she gets the city of Blois for Louis. Or this is kind of later, so kind of Louis does it, kind of Blanche does it. They're kind of jointly doing it at that point.
Yeah.
Which brings us to Louis as a young man. So he's inherited a handsome appearance from his father. From his mother's side, he's inherited a tall, slender frame.
Mm.
Blanche is a half Plantagenet, and the Plantagenets, as well as like Eleanor of Aquitaine, were known for their height. Slender. Their graceful, slender height.
Yay.
However, he was a sickly child.
Yeah, they always as are.
Pretty much all of his siblings were, hence all of the dead children. But he all obviously managed to survive. Medieval ages. Becomes king at 12, crowned in Reims. We've covered Blanche's regency in enough detail, I think, so we're going to get into that.
If you haven't listened to that, go listen to that, and then you can listen to this.
Yes.
It'll make more sense.
It was an exceptionally long regency because it was on Louis's 20th birthday that he was considered to have completed his minority. And about a month later, he married Margaret of Provence at Sens Cathedral. She was the eldest of the Count of Provence's remarkably beautiful daughters. And
Blanche didn't like her.
Blanche didn't like her. She was only 12 at the time of the marriage. She was only 12 years old, while Louis was 20. He was actually quite old for a royal groom in this time period. Usually they were marrying off their children about 12. But yeah, he had to wait for Margaret to be old enough. And they didn't have their first child until 7 years later. So thankfully.
Oh yeah, she was 12.
Thankfully. And we'll get deeper into their relationship when we get to Voulez-Vous. We'll talk about sort of what Louis was like in his like personal character. But yeah, it's a complex relationship thanks to the mother-in-law drama. So Louis, as we've mentioned, he's got these three loyal brothers. He's got Robert, Alfonso, and Charles, and they will be important partners in rule for him. Valuable pieces on the chessboard. So like if Blanche is the queen on the chessboard and Louis is the king, then Robert, Alfonso, and Charles are like the knights and the bishops.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Was one of them a bishop, actually?
No. There were no children of Blanche were sent to the church, I think.
Huh?
At all. That's sort of
not even a
gone
girl?
Out of fashion a bit. Gone out of fashion a bit.
It's like, use all your children for political alliances.
Exactly. Except the daughter, Isabella, who remained an old maid. And we'll see. It ends up becoming a saint because she gave all of her huge dowry to the Franciscans. Brothers on the chessboard. So we've got Robert in the north as the Count of Artois, and he gets married to the Countess of Brabant. So he's got lots of land around Flanders. And then we've got Alfonso in the southwest. He becomes the Count of Poitou, and he also marries the future Countess of Toulouse. So he's got all that. And then we've got Charles, who becomes Count of Anjou, but his main base of power becomes Provence.
Okay. Because
he ends up marrying the Countess of Provence, who is Margaret's younger sister, Beatrice. So two brothers and two sisters getting married. It's fine. Actually, we will see the royal families of Europe becoming a bit more incesty.
Incesty.
As the next century or so goes on.
A
lot of Capetians start marrying each other. So we'll see that increase.
First cousins.
Yeah. And it's a reflection of, I think, the state that Europe ends up in, where pretty much everyone's at war with each other.
Inbred with each other.
Yeah. So the royal family were also heavily invested in other marriage alliances that were happening throughout the kingdom. Blanche was arranging them all, particularly with various succession disputes in Flanders and surrounding lands that happen throughout the reign. But we don't really have time to get into those details. It's good fodder for a potential Patreon episode on Margaret the Black. So
yes,
maybe I'm going to leave that there.
Do that.
So let's get into, speaking of dynastic squabbles, in 1242, about 8 years into Louis's personal rule, Henry III of England decides to invade France. Becomes a pastime among these English kings.
Oh, I'm a bit bored lately. Oh, I know. Let's go invade France.
Well, of course, Henry was... We're only a generation away from having lost the Angevin Empire. So Henry III thinks he has a pretty good chance of getting it back. So he wants to reclaim the former Angevin regions of Normandy, Anjou, and Poitou. He'd already tried to invade Normandy a couple times through Brittany. But now Brittany is allied to Louis because Louis deposed Count Peter I in favor of his son, John the Red. And John the Red is, you know, happy about that. So, so Henry III instead decides to come down to his territory, his little bit of mainland France that he still has, which is Gascony in the far southwest on like the Spanish border or the border with Navarre, I guess, at this time. So he's gonna go land there and then come up through Aquitaine, get the Angevin lands back. But let's first get into the catalyst for this war, which is called the Saintonge War, because it takes place mainly in the Saintonge region between Poitiers and Bordeaux. So kind of like the middle of the west coast of France. That's where it happens. So for some reason, when conflict happens in the left of France, there's always one family that seems to be involved in it, and that is the Lusignan family. They were a big thorn in the side for the Plantagenets during the Angevin Empire. And now that France has taken over this territory, they're a thorn in the side Capetians. Yeah. Also at this time, they are cousins of the Kings of Jerusalem. So they think they're pretty important for that reason. Or not the Kings of Jerusalem, the Kings of Cyprus, I think, at this point. But they've also got Kings of Jerusalem in the family. So Hugh the 10th of Lusignan, because they're all called Hughes, this is Hugh the 10th. He'd amassed a lot of land and wealth. He was the Count of La Marche in central France and the Count of Eure in Normandy. Favorite place name in France, Eure. And through his marriage to Eleanor of Angoulême, Henry III's widowed mother, he was also the Count of Angoulême, which is in Aquitaine. But now, because Alfonso has just been made the Count of Poitiers, Hugh is expected to swear allegiance to him. And there is a big homage ceremony where Alfonso is invested and all the Aquitanian lords have to come up and like swear like loyalty to him. But Hugh the 10th openly refuses to do that in front of King Louis. And it's a big scandal. And he declares that the younger brother of the King of France is not the rightful ruler of Poitiers. It is the younger brother of the King of England, who is Earl Richard of Cornwall. So, big to do. Louis decides, well, time to bring Hugh down. And Henry III uses this as his pretext to invade France.
You can't do that.
Gotta defend stepdad. So Henry lands with a small force at Rouen in Aquitaine sometime in May 1242. And he starts gradually amassing troops from among the rebellious local lords. Meanwhile, Louis had already assembled a mighty army of 20 to 25,000 men. And by June, he had managed to capture a number of castles along the western seaboard. In the meantime, Henry was sending frantic letters to Louis, being like, let's kiss and make up. I only want to like make sure my stepdad's not getting in prison. But Louis's like, nope, he leaves them unread. He continues advancing his army towards Henry and Hugh. And they meet at the ruined castle of Taillebourg in mid-July.
Ooh, I like that name.
Yes. So Henry retreated away from the ruined fortress across the River Charente, hoping to sort of create a watery barrier between him and Louis. But Louis hunkered down in Taillebourg, set his men up on the ruined ramparts, and eventually they goaded the English into crossing the bridge and running at them.
Silly, silly.
Louis put his best foot forward, or should I say his best hoof forward, and charged his cavalry, his heavy cavalry, straight into the English as they were crossing the bridge, as they were being funneled in. And this sent shockwaves of panic through the English army, and they fled. They fled back towards the city of Saintes to try to like fortify it, to like get a more defensible position. But Louis pressed his advantage and he pursued the English army all the way back to Saintes, cutting down men as they ran away. And so by the time he got to Saintes, Henry III realized that morale had completely broken down. He'd lost like half his army. And so he booked it back to England.
As you would.
And he abandons Hugh de Lusignan, who emerges from the city of Saintes after only 2 days of sieging and prostrates himself before Louis in a flood of tears and surrenders.
You're like, I didn't mean to.
Yeah. Hugh apparently manages to keep all of his titles, but he has to surrender a bunch of land and castles to King Louis. So he's essentially, you know, got kneecapped by the king. So then after a brief detour west, not west, east, to subdue Toulouse, which had rebelled again, you know, may as well while you're down south, Louis returned home and began negotiating with Henry. The King of England agreed to a 5-year truce with Louis and paid him a humiliating indemnity of £5,000. And this was the beginning of a slippery slope for Henry that led to the Second Barons' War 15 years later against Simon de Montfort. Both the Saintonge War and the subjugation of Toulouse established that Louis was no longer a boy. He ought to be respected just as much as his father and his grandfather. Yeah. In the meantime, Henry III retreats back into his turtle shell in England, and he makes some defensive alliances, including one with the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II. So let's get to what's happening with Frederick. Yes. Frederick von Hohenstaufen. He is the grandson of Frederick Barbarossa, and he's been around for a while. So at the age of 4, Frederick II became the King of Sicily through his mother Constance, who was the last Norman ruler of Sicily. Then at the age of 16, he became the Holy Roman Emperor after the title was briefly usurped by Otto IV of the House of Welf, who Philip Augustus beat at the Battle of Bouvines.
And
if you'll remember, the Otto versus Frederick rivalry was the start of the Guelphs versus Ghibellines rivalry, which will last long after both of them are dead. It sort of morphs into more than just a dynastic dispute, because the Guelphs become the supporters of the Papal States and the Pope's power, while the Ghibellines support the Hohenstaufen dynasty and the power of the Emperor.
Hohenstaufen.
And don't know if you can guess which side the French normally align with.
Papal.
Yeah, the Pope. Because if the Pope runs to France and gets exiled to France, then France has a lot of power to dictate papal policy and stuff. Yeah. And we'll see Louis use this to full effect in his reign.
May as well.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a tumultuous relationship with Frederick. But somehow Frederick also finds time to go on crusades. He leads the Sixth Crusade to the Holy Land in the 1220s, and he ends up capturing Jerusalem in 1229, which is something that no one's really been able to do since the First Crusade.
Yeah.
Frederick passed the title of King of Jerusalem to his son Conrad, but they were sort of like absentee rulers of Jerusalem. They kind of left the Frankish lords in Jerusalem to do their own thing. Jerusalem was kind of ruled by the kings of Cyprus, who were the Lusignan family, coming full circle to the Lusignan. Yeah. Oh, we also get, because of Louis' support of the Pope, the Hohenstaufens eventually lose Sicily to Charles of Anjou, the Count of Provence, who gets declared as the King of Sicily by Pope Innocent the Fourth? One of the Fourths. Frederick, having gone on crusade, kind of threw a wrench into the crusader states, because now we've got kind of two factions where some are loyal to the Western Emperor and some are loyal to the Eastern Emperor, because remember, there were crusaders who took over the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah.
Took over Constantinople.
Yeah.
Although it's not really an empire, because they kind of just control Constantinople and they're like surrounded by enemies.
It's more like a little state.
Yes. And at this point, they are completely bankrupt. King Baldwin II of Constantinople, or Emperor Baldwin II of Constantinople, is completely poor, surrounded by enemies. And he's a Capetian, by the way. He's part of the House of Courtenay, who are descended from Louis the...
Something.
I think, actually, Philip the First they're descended from. So they're kind of way back. So Baldwin ends up coming to France. And he hears that Louis the Ninth has something of a penchant for collecting relics. So he comes in with a lot of fancy relics that he didn't at all steal from the Byzantines, and including the Crown of Thorns.
The one they magically managed to save, right? In Notre Dame.
In Notre Dame? Yeah. Oh, yeah, it would be in Notre Dame. Is it Notre Dame?
Yeah, I swear it was. It was some relic that was in Notre Dame when it was getting on fire. I remember they were like, oh, phew, but we got time to save the relics.
Well, including
Louis... a thorn or something.
Louis builds a chapel called Sainte-Chapelle specifically to house the Crown of Thorns. So I don't know if it's in Notre Dame. It might be now.
Oh, some relic was. Something to do with Jesus.
Something to do with Jesus. Yeah, well, there's loads of relics that Louis the Ninth acquires. He also gets one of the holy nails. He already has one of the holy nails that nailed Jesus to the cross. In fact, it gets lost. And Louis, when he's like 15 years old, he's like, do everything to save the relic. And he like puts out a reward to find the relic again. And it was found. There's also the holy lance he has. And there was another one as well. The holy sponge, which is lovely. The sponge that was used, I think, maybe to clean Jesus' body when he was being entombed.
Mm. Okay, so it stayed there until the French Revolution, and then it was moved to Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah, because Sainte-Chapelle was badly damaged. We'll get to that in Notre Dame.
I knew I was right. I'm not happy that more I'm right. It's more I'm happy that, like, yay, my memory hasn't failed
You know
me.
Something. Yeah. So yeah,
my memory hasn't failed.
So Louis the Ninth actually, he wins a bidding war with the Doge of Venice to get the Crown of Thorns. So he spends a lot of money to get that crown.
People aren't happy.
And this is just before the Saintonge War. And then after the Saintonge War, it becomes clear that Louis
earned it.
Is really obsessed with going on crusade. Not in debt. The French crown is flush with cash. They're in the middle of a golden age. Everything's great.
Okay.
That's why they had all this cash to give to Baldwin. It was also kind of a donation to Constantinople because they were like, you guys are struggling. Louis was thoroughly convinced to go on crusade by Baldwin. As we covered last episode, he doesn't initially go. He sends Tybalt of Champagne on a sort of mini... in-betweeny crusade in 1239.
Kind of scouting it out.
Yeah, well, not necessarily scouting it out as much as charging in and doing as much damage as possible, which is what ends up happening. So this is called the Baron's Crusade. And and he goes along with, like, Peter of Brittany and a bunch of other lords who basically Louis just wants to get rid of.
Send you to your death.
Yeah, it was a bit of a disaster, though. So Frederick II had left the Kingdom of Jerusalem in a pretty good place. They'd made peace with the Sultan of the Ayyubids, who ruled Egypt and Syria. They were the descendants of Saladin, by the way. And this peace was absolutely wrecked when, like, a bunch of Frenchmen just came in and ignored all of the treaties that had been made and tried to, you know, expand the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Yeah. And they ended up squabbling amongst themselves and having to leave only a year in. They left the Kingdom of Jerusalem so weakened that just a couple years later in 1244, Jerusalem was retaken by the Ayyubids with the help of the Khwarazmian army. The Khwarazmians are very interesting.
They have a cool name.
They have a cool name. So they were the Turkish rulers of Persia from the 11th to 13th centuries. Until 1231, when they fell to, guess who's charging in to our history? On horses, with bows.
Mongolians?
Yes, the Mongols. Yay! They're here. They've arrived.
My favorite.
Yes. So rather than get completely destroyed, the Khwarazmian army actually just left Persia, went west. And they became sort of mercenaries for the Ayyubids. The Ayyubids eventually, like, snuff them out because they become too troublesome. But for now, in 1244, the Ayyubids allow the Khwarazmians to help them take Jerusalem. And they sack the city. And this is a devastating blow, which leads directly to Louis the Ninth calling
a crusade.
Yeah.
What number crusade is this?
Seven. Number seven.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Too bad it was the number nine to go of him being the ninth. That would be nice.
So defying their mother, Blanche, who begged them to stay and was completely traumatized by their abandonment, Louis and all three of his brothers and all of their wives as well confirmed their commitment to taking the cross before Pope Innocent himself at the 1245 Council of Lyon. And King Louis then called up an enormous army consisting of the Duke of Burgundy, the new Count of Flanders, the husband of Margaret the Black, as well as Hugh the 11th of Lusignan, who is the half-brother of Henry the Third, because Hugh the 10th has died by this point.
Yeah. Isn't it a failure, that crusade?
I'm not just going to tell you what happens in the end. We've just started.
Can you talk about it in Blanche's?
No, because Blanche dies before they come back.
Oh, I guess I'm thinking of a different crusade.
Well,
so many of them that failed. It's hard to keep track of which one succeeded.
I did imply that it didn't go super well, but we'll get to it again. We'll get to it. Okay. But yeah, we have this lovely account from Jean de Joinville, who is a minor lord from Champagne, whose account is a really excellent read. For once, we aren't getting a monk writing the history. We're getting like a military commander writing the history.
That's nice. Something different.
Something different. And it also shows how much knights were being educated in this period.
Yeah, that's really good.
They're not just brick-headed warriors now anymore.
Now, if some more women had been educated during that period, that would have been even more amazing.
Yeah. Actually, the women were generally just as well educated. The noble women were just as well educated because they had more time to sit around and, you know, read.
Cross-stitch.
Yeah, or stitch. Well, I think often noble women, they'd sort of get their servants to read to them while stitching. Yeah. But anyway, Jean de Joinville, he's this good, like, military tactician guy, but he's not afraid of some flowery language sometimes. Yeah.
Oh.
So as much as the crusade was supposed to be a way of uniting the whole of Christendom, Louis failed to gather any meaningful allies outside of France. So the lords of Germany, Italy, and Spain were all too preoccupied with their own stuff. But he did get some Norman English lords, like Henry III's cousin, William Longespay. He did join up. Louis IX's army was the best prepared and best equipped crusading force that had ever been raised.
Oh, wow.
Louis had spent half a decade making intensive preparations. He even went as far as founding a new port on the Mediterranean called Aigues-Mortes, specifically for the purpose of embarking his fleet, which he'd rented the ships from Marseille and Genoa. he departed in a great ceremony with a horde of priests chanting and singing on the ships.
Pageantry.
Lots of pageantry. And Louis, of course, he had the Oriflamme standard with him from Saint-Denis.
Mm-hmm.
And his flagship was called the Montjoie, as in the battle cry Montjoie Saint-Denis.
Oh, nice.
So they set out on the 25th of August, 1248. And they headed swiftly across the Mediterranean, landing 3 weeks later on the island of Cyprus, which was sort of their base, you know, crusader-controlled base where they could then launch an invasion. And they, like, wait for everyone to, you know, land there and gather before they made any moves.
Yeah, in case anyone had some little detours on the way.
Yes. And guess where Louis decides as his first target for the crusade?
Jerusalem?
Not Jerusalem, actually.
Constantinople.
Not Constantinople either. So Constantinople, controlled by crusaders. Jerusalem, not controlled by crusaders. But he goes in a different direction.
Egypt.
Egypt, exactly. Egypt was the heart of the Ayyubid Sultanate, who his capital is in Cairo. So
damn, he was like, let's just go straight there.
Yeah, Louis decides to take the fight straight to him.
Well, he was like, let's skip all the fanfare.
Chop off the serpent's head, basically. The Fifth Crusade had actually had a similar approach, Frederick's Crusade. Before they'd gone and captured Jerusalem, they'd tried invading Egypt, but they'd failed. So they'd captured Damietta on the north coast, and then they sort of waded through the Nile Delta, and then they were defeated at Mansoura. Okay. So guess what Louis does?
Same thing.
he takes Damietta and then wades through to Mansoura. let's see if his plan, if the same plan works.
I doubt it.
Initially, things looked really good for the Crusaders. They landed in Egypt with overwhelming force. They caught Sultan As-Sali Ayyub, Saladin's great nephew, off guard, because he was away from a civil war in Syria, and he was so ill at the time that people doubted whether he'd be able to return in one piece.
Yeah.
He had a bad, I think it was an abscess in his leg. Not dysentery, no. We'll get to the dysentery.
infection.
So Ayyub heard of Louis's capture of Damietta, and he sent a delegation to him offering to exchange this valuable port city for...
protection? Letting him live?
For another city.
Jerusalem?
Jerusalem. But Louis refuses to engage in political negotiations with the infidel. At this point, most of Louis's barons were counseling him to go west to take Alexandria.
Yeah.
Because Alexandria was extremely rich, very strategically good to have, and also held a lot of holy significance to the Christians, because a lot of saints come from Alexandria.
They do? Ooh, who knew? I just always think of that horrible histories scene. Where they're going, and this one's Alexandria, and this one's Alexandria.
Yeah, this is, I'm talking about the Alexandria here, yeah.
That was my favourite scene from that show.
But Robert of Artois, Louis's brother, told him, no, we're going to Cairo. We're chopping off the serpent's head. We're doing this quick smart.
He's like, okay, bro, let's go.
So Louis left his heavily pregnant wife, Margaret, in charge of Damietta and like a garrison.
What baby was this for her?
This would be baby number 4 for her. So she had the first 3 back in France and left them behind.
Ooh,
but she's going to keep having babies on the crusade.
My God, it's like an international baby.
International exotic baby.
Well, come on, just not born in France.
Yeah, but we'll get back to her. So progress down the Nile Delta for the French army was extremely slow. Joinville calls Egypt a, quote, earthly paradise, but it certainly had its drawbacks if you were trying to invade it, especially in the summer, which was flood season for the Nile River.
Yeah, that's a silly billy.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's hot, it's sticky, it's really not good. There's disease, there's dysentery, all sorts. Crusaders try to dam the river as they proceed or like build causeways across the marshland. But they're very easy for the Egyptians to like sabotage.
To dismantle.
Yeah. There's also roving guerrilla fighters who the Sultan offered, quote, a gold bezant for every Christian man's head. So as a result, Crusaders would wake up to find the bodies of fellow Crusaders lying next to them with the head missing. Yeah.
Ooh, picked off one by one.
And eventually, Robert of Artois, whose whole idea this was...
We shouldn't have done this.
You know, he's still gung-ho, but he grew very impatient with this slow pace of the army. So he decides to ride ahead with a small elite force to Mansoura, thinking, I'll take the city by surprise. We'll see. So he goes with a small strike force of 300 elite Templar knights. By the way, we haven't really gotten into the Templars, but they are a big deal.
Yeah.
They start to be a big deal in this period. They're an extremely rich order of knights who were initially set up to defend the Temple of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And they're now based in Cyprus.
How did that go?
For obvious reasons. Yeah. How did that go?
We should do an episode on them.
Oh, we will get into plenty of detail about the Templars, believe me.
Oh, good.
They get very important in the history of France.
I think I just like saying Templars.
But for now, we've got Robert leading this little strike force.
Do it. I feel as though he wasn't doing it because surprise attack, more being like, I want the glory to say I called it like by myself.
He's been the second brother his whole life. He wants
in
a
the
bit
shadows.
Of that, bit of that
yeah, he
glory.
Wants a bit of the spotlight.
Exactly. And he's accompanied by William Longespay, the English commander, as well.
Ah.
So they've got some Templars, some English, elite force.
Nice little mix.
Yeah. Meanwhile, things aren't necessarily going great for the Egyptian side. Mm-hmm. So Sultan Ayyub manages to arrive back home in Egypt and, like, set up his defense force in Mansoura. But while he was positioning his army, his physicians tried to save his life by amputating the leg. Yeah.
I'm guessing that killed him.
It killed him, yes. But the people around him didn't want word to get out that he died because that would just destroy the army's morale. So his wife, Shajar al-Dur, takes charge.
Yes.
Because her stepson, Turan Shah, who's meant to be the new sultan and who would take her out of power, is far away. So she's like, I'll just rule on behalf of the sultan, who's definitely still alive.
Yeah. His body's not rotting away.
Yeah. Just everyone ignore the smell coming from that tent. He's fine.
And those flies.
And the flies, yeah. There's flies everywhere anyway. It's Egypt. It's whatever. Yeah. So
it's a flood smell.
Yeah.
The smell we get every time of year around the floods. It's not a rotting body.
That's just the mud. It's fine. Whatever. So the Egyptians had an elite force of their own to face the Templar Knights. And these were the Mamluks. I don't know if you've heard of the Mamluks.
Feels like I've heard the name, but I don't know anything about.
So Mamluk simply means slave in Arabic. So they were like an elite force of slave soldiers, generally drawn from non-Arab lands. So a lot of them were Turks or Caucasians.
I'm feeling sorry for them now.
Yeah, well, don't feel too sorry for them because they end up becoming an elite, almost like noble class within Egypt. They're kind of like, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Janissaries in the Ottoman Empire. The Mamluks are kind of a precursor to that, where they're like this initially underclass of like slave soldiers, kind of like the Unsullied from Game of Thrones.
Oh.
Although they're not, I don't know if they're eunuchs. They eventually rise to become essentially the power behind the Egyptian throne.
Oh, cool. So you want them on your side?
Yes. So Shajar al-Dur currently is allied with the Mamluks. We'll see that maybe change in the future. So Shajar al-Dur receives warning of Robert's speedy advance force when they take the nearby town of Gedala. So they kind of ruin their cover. So she confers with the Mamluk leader, Baybars al-Budukhtari, who advises her to open the gate, let Robert inside.
And then
what
kill him.
So Robert of Artois reaches Mansoura, sees no Ayyubid flags at all, assumes the army has just left, charges straight in, and gate shuts behind him, Mamluks close in, citizens of Mansoura throw stones at them from the roofs, and it's just carnage. They have to lock themselves inside a house. And if this was a movie, they would, like, hold out until, like, the last moment when, like, Louis the Ninth could finally get there.
But
this
isn't
a movie.
They die.
They are slaughtered, except for four of them, and one of them is not Robert. Or William. Oh. William dies as well.
Oh.
Yeah. So, King Louis, he manages to capture a bridge leading to the city, and Joinville tells us that he learned of the victory at the bridge at the same time as he learned that his brother had been killed in Mansoura. And Louis made a prayer of thanksgiving for the victory while he shed tears.
I can imagine him like being like, yeah, smiling, and then just bursting into tears and smiling and then bursting into tears and just being like.
Yeah. So the crusading army, or at least the ones that hadn't been slaughtered.
You mean the four?
No. The ones that Louis was commanding.
That's all that's left. It's just this four
plus
people.
Plus the four that were left, yeah. So they set up a fortified camp.
How did they survive those four?
Yeah, I know. It's not made clear. They could walk through walls, I guess. And the Egyptians attack the crusading camp with bolts lit by Greek fire, which they'd also used to defend Damietta. And Joinville describes these firebolts looking like stars falling from heaven.
Cool.
Scary as well.
Not good for French.
Not good for France. So despite this flashy artillery, the crusaders managed to rout the Egyptian army and take Mansoura. But it is a rather pyrrhic victory.
Yeah.
He'd lost not only his brother, but much of his army to disease, and he was still less than halfway to Cairo, with the Egyptians sealing off all the routes forward and surrounding Mansoura to cut his supply lines. So Louis decides to cut his losses, retreat back to Damietta by water. So he's going up on a barge, back down the Nile. And he had to be transported on the river because he was ill with dysentery. Yeah, he was bedridden. And this is the disease that killed his father, of course.
Can you survive once you get dysentery?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Louis does recover from this dysentery. Spoiler alert.
Oh.
Yeah. But this will not be the first time he gets dysentery. So,
family curse much?
Yeah. So to make matters catastrophically worse, on the way back down the Nile, Louis' thin army train was ambushed, resulting in the capture and imprisonment of thousands of crusaders, including...
his brothers? Another and brother. His wife?
No, his wife's not with them.
Oh. Both
him, brothers? Him. Oh. Louis. Louis and both his brothers get captured. Both his remaining brothers.
Oh, how embarrassing.
Sucks for them.
When was the last time a French king even got captured? Ever?
I think this is kind of the first time. It's definitely the first time a French king has been captured on crusade.
Yeah. Usually it's Richard.
I think it's the first time at least Capetian king has been captured. Don't know. Anyway, but he won't be the last king of France to be captured. Let's just say that. But Louis was treated with every dignity by the Egyptians. They called him Al-Francis. And they gave him a princely guard and his own household of servants.
You mean not a guard, more like watchers?
Yeah, their guard as well. Their sultan, Turan Shah, did send Louis' white royal mantle to Damascus, which was dyed red with Christian blood. So that's cool.
Woo!
Yeah. But as polite as they were to him, Louis was not best pleased at being captured, obviously, and he was also ill. Mm-hmm. He sometimes lashed out at his Egyptian servants. At one point, he said to the chronicler Husam al-Din, "I ask you in the name of your religion to kill me at once and relieve me of this servant at the sight of him. He is the worst of what I am currently enduring." So he's a bit snappy. Is
Louis. Oh my god, he hates the servant that much. He's like, I'd just rather die than be a second log in his servant's presence.
Yeah. It's kind of kind of reminiscent of how Blanche speaks. She was like, oh, I'd rather you were dead than this effort. Yeah.
Like, I'll just sell my sons.
I'll just sell my sons then. So Louis does seem to have softened over time. Apparently he won the Egyptians over with his sense of humor, and Husam al-Din ultimately calls him a thoughtful and intelligent man.
I wonder what their language in common was. Latin?
Probably Greek, actually. Probably Greek would have been the main language spoken. Or at least the common language spoken in the East, yeah.
Oh, I'm never going to get over that servant line. That's the best thing. It's like, I hate you that much. I'd rather die than be in your presence for a second longer.
Just chop my head off now.
And it's not even like another royal, it's a servant that he's that disgusted with.
Speaking of heads getting chopped off, let's go to Queen Margaret back in Damietta.
Oh God.
She's freaking the hell out. So she'd been left for months with only a small garrison forced to defend her, and she was heavily pregnant as well.
She must have had the baby by now.
No, it's only been a few. It's only been a few weeks.
Oh, really? It feels like it's been years.
But she was terrified not just for her own safety, but for the other women and children in her care, including her sister Beatrice and their sister-in-law, Countess Matilda of Artois, Robert's recent widow, who was also pregnant. Yeah. Not fun times. Yeah. So during Margaret's childbirth, she screamed in both pain and terror that the Muslims would attack Damietta and violate her and her sisters. And to comfort her, one elderly knight squeezed her hand during the labor and told her that he would not let them take her alive and he would cut her head off if the infidel breached the walls.
Lovely. That'll make you feel better.
Yeah, that was intended to comfort the queen while she was giving birth. But Queen Margaret, she ended up pulling through, giving birth to a son who she named John Tristan. Tristan coming from the French word for sadness. Tristesse. Yeah, and while she was in her bed recovering, Margaret issued messages to Sultan Turan Shah offering to ransom her husband for a whopping 800,000 gold bezants. So half now, half when Louis and his brothers were returned, although the second half never actually ended up being sent. And once she got her men back, Margaret just noped out of Egypt very quickly before they could demand the rest of the payment. I mean, the Egyptians couldn't do much about it because they were suddenly embroiled in a civil war.
Ooh.
Sultan Turan Shah was assassinated by the Mamluks only a year into his reign.
Oh.
And Shajar al-Durr gained control, but only very briefly, because the Mamluks ensured that she was assassinated. She was beaten to death by the clogs of her maidservants, which is fun.
Ooh.
Then the Mamluks set up a puppet regime under Sultan al-Mustansir, and this puppet regime of the Mamluks would last until 1517, when the Ottoman Empire took over Egypt.
Wow.
So that's a bit of a side note on the Egyptian situation. So the Crusaders set sail for Acre, and they'd finally reached the Holy Land after that failed detour in Egypt.
Thing.
Yeah. So the mighty citadel of Acre was the capital of the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem, because they don't have Jerusalem. So now that Louis IX was there, he kind of spent the next 4 years essentially ruling Jerusalem as a sort of second kingdom. Because the, as we said before, the emperor was the king of Jerusalem, and he kind of was doing emperor back in Germany. Yeah, so Louis improved the defenses of the main strongholds of Jaffa, Sidon, Acre, and Caesarea. Louis the IX's wars in Caesarea still exist, so that's nice.
Oh wow!
He became suddenly more diplomatic when it came to dealing with the Ayyubids.
Well, after
maybe learning from his captivity. He became more like savvy to their ways, and he played the Ayyubids and the Mamluks off each other as they had their civil war. Yeah.
Smart.
So it was kind of like a weirdly peaceful time when he was in the Holy Land. He went on some pilgrimages, including to the town of Nazareth, where Jesus was raised.
Mm-hmm. Can you just imagine him fangirling, being like, oh my God, oh God, I can't believe I'm here where Jesus
basically.
Is born. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah. And the Arabs even offered to escort him on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And they promised that he would receive safe passage. But Louis turns that offer down. He's like, no, I'm not taking any chances.
I don't need to be captured again.
And when he goes to Sidon, he hears of a local massacre of the Christians by resentful local Arabs. And he personally helps bury the bodies of these dead Christians.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it is there in Sidon in 1252 when Louis hears about the death, or maybe early 1253 actually, where Louis hears about the death of his mother, Blanche of Castile.
Thought you were going to say he had a vision or something.
No, he doesn't have any visions actually.
But he really wished he did.
He really would love to have some visions.
I know. It'd make his life.
Yeah. But yeah, Blanche's dead. So Louis has to get back because France is descending into chaos. His brothers are back home by now, but they're kind of just doing their own thing, securing their own lands. Louis's eldest son and heir, the 10-year-old Prince Louis, was in theory now the regent, but he's 10. So instead, Blanche's like council of bishops are trying to rule, but they're squabbling amongst themselves. It's not going very well.
Yeah, so.
This is actually the closest that Prince Louis will get to being king because he caught the chills in New Year 1260, a bit later on, and he died a month later. But thankfully, he's got four younger brothers, so that's all fine. It's okay. So Louis spent the next 13 years or so putting his realm in order, establishing peace, and making reforms. But we'll get into further detail about this period in Voulez-Vous. So let's skip all the way forward to the 24th of March 1267, when Louis, who's now a very infirm old man in his mid-50s, pledges to
a crusade.
Another crusade. The Eighth Crusade.
No!
Yeah.
You're old.
Yeah.
Stay at home.
France just got back on track, and now Louis is like, let's go on another crusade. And he's taking three of his four sons with him.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Is he asking for them to die? Does he just not care about them at all? At least only take two.
Louis left the kingdom in the care of a council of nobles, which conspicuously excluded Queen Margaret, who was given a reduced allowance to prevent her from seizing power. On top of that, Louis was separating her from the heir, Philip, who she tried to like get her claws into a bit. She tried to make him swear allegiance to her so that she'd have the same influence that Blanche had. But Louis dragged Philip before Pope Urban IV to make him reverse Philip's oath. As you might suspect, unlike the Seventh Crusade, the Eighth was met with extreme opposition throughout the kingdom.
Yeah.
Jean de Joinville was among the many lords who declined to come this time around. So we actually get a less thorough record of this next crusade because Joinville is not there. And minstrels were openly mocking the king as the monk king who preferred pilgrimages to ruling. Actually, at one point before he took the cross, Louis had actually been considering abdicating the throne and becoming a monk.
Damn.
Which is a thing that some kings do. Not kings of France, but other various kings. And we've seen also queens like Blanche take the veil before their death. Yeah. So Louis is like, instead of just becoming a monk and quietly abdicating and slinking off, like, I'm going
to... Nah, let's send people to their deaths.
Embroil the entire kingdom in another crusade. Even the Pope, who's now Clement IV, who was a French Pope, was like, do you want to reconsider this maybe, Louis? I don't know if I want to call another crusade. We've kind of got this emperor. We've got a new emperor, and he's like just as bad as the old emperor. But Louis ignored them all. He left France in 1270 and assembled forces on the island of Sardinia. He did have quite a few French people who did come. At the end of the day, he still had a lot of money.
So what did he promise them?
Money. And, you know, you get absolution for your sins if you go on crusade.
Oh, cool.
But he was also joined in Sardinia by Prince Edward of England, the future Edward I, and his wife, Eleanor of Castile, who was actually the great niece of Blanche of Castile. They're going on crusade.
It's a nice little honeymoon.
Yeah, nice little honeymoon for them. Louis's brother, Charles of Anjou, is actually expected to come on crusade as well. He's by now the King of Sicily. But he's a bit slow. He's a bit slow in joining them because he really wants them to attack the Byzantine Empire, because while everything's been happening, the Latin Emperor of Constantinople has lost the city to the Byzantines. So the Byzantine Empire is now a thing again.
Making a comeback.
They're threatening Charles and Sicily. So Charles wants Louis to attack the Byzantines. Others want Louis to just go back to the Holy Land again. But Louis decides that his initial target for the crusade is going to be Tunis. Which, do you know where Tunis is?
Tunisia?
Yes, it's the capital of Tunisia now. Yeah. At the time, it was its own sort of emirate. Actually, the ruler of Tunis becomes a caliph, actually. The caliph in North Africa. I think he's the Shiite caliph. Yeah. But Louis had heard rumors from Dominican that the ruler of Tunis was considering converting to Christianity. This turned out to not be true. So when Louis's massive crusading army showed up in Tunis, they were not so welcome. So they started besieging Tunis. But of course, our old friend Dysentery decides to show up again. Louis and his son, John Tristan, both succumb to the illness. So John Tristan dies 3 weeks before Louis in August 1270. And Louis was 56 years old and he'd reigned since the age of 12.
Wow.
Yeah.
Long reign.
We have reason to think it wasn't just dysentery that killed Louis, though, because his jawbone, which is housed in Notre Dame Cathedral, it was examined in 2019 and they found evidence of scurvy. So it's probably the case that scurvy weakened his immune system and that's allowed the dysentery to take him out. Scurvy leads to teeth falling out, gums rotting, and anemia as well. Yeah, it's not good. Ironically, he was in Tunis, which has loads of fruit that would have cured the scurvy, but he preferred a diet of just fish.
Oh.
Yeah. So
no loaves?
Probably loaves as well, as like trenches for the fish, but mainly fish, which is not great for scurvy if you just eat fish. Yeah. So I will leave us on a bit of a cliffhanger for what happens next in this crusade and whether or not Louis's son, Philip III, gets back to France, because he's, of course, on crusade with Louis. So, you know, what'll happen? Cliffhanger. What I can tell you is that 20 years after his death, there was a successful bid to canonize King Louis IX.
Oh.
So, as a result, Louis IX is the Saint Louis.
Oh.
As in St. Louis, Missouri. Yeah, he's that Louis.
Damn.
So, that is the bare bones of his reign, and so we're going to dive into different aspects of his rule in rounds. So let's get into Enchanté.
Yes.
Enchanté.
This is a portrait by De Creuse from the 19th century. It's the one we're going to use.
It's very solemn.
Yeah, well, he was a solemn dude, as we're going to learn.
Clutching that sword to his chest for dear life.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, you can see the clenching of the hands.
Yeah, the holding of the sword, weirdly, is a thing that happens throughout art. He holds it by the wrong end. Because I think it's a symbol of how he was like a peaceable king rather than warlike, at least towards Christians, yeah. I should say.
A nice blue robe with the fleur-de-lis on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a little bit, it's got some chainmail on underneath that. It's got a crown, obviously. And his hair is like, look, poof, poof.
He's got floofy hair that kind of goes outwards a
bit. Yeah.
And a very French-looking nose.
Mm. And dead soulless eyes.
Yeah. Dead soulless eyes, but like a bit of a smirking mouth. But he's like,
I don't think it's smirking. I think it's more like...
Not smirking, like...
Like disgruntled.
Disgruntled,
not
yeah.
Disgruntled, yeah, a bit disgruntled, but a bit like... Mm.
It's like...
That. Mm. That's the sound he's making in this portrait. He's like... Mm.
I feel like he would talk like this. I'm not very satisfied today. My name is Louis. You will treat me with respect.
Does it look like, is that just his like mouth line, or does it look like he's a scar on his cheek, or is that just a painting weird?
I think it's just the damage of the painting.
Okay.
But then of course we also have a contemporary depiction, which we looked at last episode.
Oh, is it the one with Blanche and
it was the there's... Yeah. It was the gold, nice gold one where like Louis is young and Blanche is like teaching him. Yeah. That sort of one.
I don't want you to go on crusades. He's going, yes, mother, but in it he's thinking, yeah, right, I'm definitely going.
Then moving ahead in his life, we have a lovely painting by one of my favorite French artists, Eugène Delacroix, who depicts the Battle of Taillebourg against the English, where Louis sort of charges them on the bridge. Looking very heroic there in battle. With his mace.
What is he? Oh, yeah, he's holding. And then, oh no, there's a horse being like, ah!
Horse is trampling some Englishmen.
People falling into the rivers. Oh, chaos. Yeah. Like war is meant to be.
Then we've got this medieval one's quite funny. It's Louis kneeling before the Pope, and the Pope's got his stack of crowns on his head.
Yeah, it's like a crown and a crown and a crown.
Yeah, that's fun.
And then he's got the beekeepers behind him.
Yep. Then we come to medieval depictions of Louis' death. We've got him dying in his tent outside Tunis. Medieval depiction of that.
And there's the blood flag.
The what flag?
The flag. The blood flag.
Oh, the Oriflamme. Yeah. No. It's not a blood flag. That's a thing that Vikings made up.
The white flame that they took?
No. Yeah, it's the Oriflamme. The white flag. It's not I said the royal mantle, which was white, they took.
Yeah, and it's on the ground there now.
What? What are you talking about?
Aren't they the enemy?
No, that's the Oriflamme. The royal mantle is Louis's coat, Louis's robe.
Oh.
And it's white.
I thought because isn't that like the enemy army?
Yeah, but this is a different point in Louis's life. This is when he dies. Oh. Not when he gets captured.
When
he gets captured, they don't manage to take the Oriflamme. The Oriflamme remains in French hands until Battle of Agincourt.
Okay. I love how his clothing matches the tent.
Yeah, they love their everything covered in.
Yeah, he's like, I need to coordinate for my tent as I lie here dying.
Well, we also have another depiction of his coffin here, which has the same deal. It's covered in fleur-de-lis. This is his coffin getting brought back to France.
Is that a knight on a weird horse?
It's being carried by the soldiers, and then there's a horse with its butt hanging out the edge of the picture.
And its head's missing.
And half its head's missing. Yeah, that's weird.
Its head turned into a human arm! It's a freak of nature!
Yeah. So those are... medieval depictions of Louis, at least.
Now I'm just going to imagine him having a horse with an arm face.
That's not him. That's not the king.
I know, but it looks like horse.
That's his son, actually. That's Philip.
But Philip's also missing some leg.
Louis in the box. He's dead.
Yeah, I know that. Well, now his son is the
arm. Now his son has a horse with an arm for a head. Yeah. Let's imagine that for all of next episode.
Yeah. So now then going, he better have a horse related death.
We're gonna see. So Louis, he was sometimes called Louis of Poissy because that's where he was born. He was born in Poissy. But because he's a saint, he's also called Louis the Saint. More often Saint Louis. So those are the epithets.
Is he our first royal king saint?
Yes. First and only king of France to be a saint. Yeah.
Cool. He's going to get some major points for that.
Yeah. Even Charlemagne didn't get that honor.
Damn.
The emperors tried to make Charlemagne a saint, but unsuccessful. Doesn't happen. Louis' physical description, he was very slender, perhaps due to his restrictive diet. And according to the chronicler Salimben, he had the face of an angel and the eyes of a dove.
That's a very nice description.
Joinville describes him on his first crusade as, quote, the handsomest knight he'd ever seen.
Damn.
Yeah. In terms of Louis' character, it's a bit clouded by writers who just overly praise him because they want to make him a saint. That's the goal of what they're writing.
Well, we know he had a bit of spark to him, like what he said to the servant.
Yeah. One of the people to write in praise of Louis was his own son, Philip, who wrote to the Pope when he died. He wrote, "Everyone grieves equally for the pious king, the peaceful king, the father of the poor, the refuge of the miserable, the consolation of the oppressed, the particular champion of all religion and innocence, the zealous supporter of justice, the defender of the faith and the church." That's a long list.
When you're saying that titles, all I was thinking was like, when they're like, you know, Daenerys, Stormborn, you know. Oh, spiel of that.
Breaker of chains.
Chains. Yeah. Mother of dragons.
Inferences can be made towards some negative aspects of Louis' character, which we kind of saw a bit with him yelling at the servant. Elizabeth Hallam picks apart some of Joinville's biography and writes that Louis had the tendency to be, quote, impulsive, stubborn, tactless, and impatient, startlingly willful and impetuous, quickly roused to anger, unwilling to take advice from his counselors.
Yeah.
And the Seventh Crusade in particular manifested some of this impatience.
And the Eighth one did too, when he was like, I'm doing it no matter what.
Yeah. And Louis suffers a lot in this crusade. By the time he gets back home, like Philip II before him, all of his hair had fallen out.
Ooh.
He developed a stoop as well, he's no longer the tall, gallant king that he was before. However, we should give Louis massive props, as you said, not just for being a saint, but for actively shaping his own kingly image. And this was something that Blanche passed down to him as like, you need to conduct yourself as this great holy king. And we see that with him obtaining the Crown of Thorns, building Sainte-Chapelle, this amazing royal chapel and reliquary to house his very large collection of religious knickknacks that he picked up. Yeah, his hoard.
The dragon relics.
And as you said, Sainte-Chapelle got damaged during the French Revolution. A lot of the relics had to be moved or were destroyed. The building of Sainte-Chapelle was part of the spectacle surrounding the leaving of the Seventh Crusade. Not as much spectacle for the Eighth Crusade.
No one wanted to go.
Yeah, but there was again more pomp and ceremony surrounding the later sainthood, which in a way reflects him as well, even though it happened 20 years later. And of course, on the way back to France, Philip has to cart Louis' remains through all of Italy, and it kind of develops this kind of like there's this tradition that crops up called the Stages of Saint Louis, where people go on pilgrimage to follow Louis' body.
So there's no barrel?
No barrel. They actually, interestingly, they did a process to stop the putrefaction of the body where they basically boiled away all of the flesh from the bone. They stored this flesh in a jar and they separated out the bones. So like they were like, this part can be here and this part can be here. And it became relics that were scattered around. That's why his jawbone, which is in Notre Dame is separate from the rest of his body because he's buried at Saint-Denis.
So how many parts of his body is relic?
All parts of his body can be relic.
Yeah, I mean, like, which ones are scattered?
Jawbone is in Notre Dame. Entrails are somewhere else. But, yeah.
Imagine the person who's in charge of doing that.
Yeah, well, Philip was in charge of doing that, I presume. And Charles of Anjou as well.
Yeah, I know, but he didn't actually do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, they'd have, like, royal embalmers to do that.
Yeah.
They
learned after that. They were like, we don't want another barrel
king.
Yeah,
they learned their lesson, I suppose. Their technology had improved when it came to, you know, corpses.
Dead beds.
So, yeah, we have more depictions of Louis going into, like, the early modern period with, like, Renaissance stuff. We've got El Greco's very famous portrait of Louis the Ninth, which I'll show you, which is produced during the Spanish Renaissance.
Oh, yeah.
Very nice.
Oh, my God, it looks like Charles.
Ah! Which Charles?
Current king.
Oh, England. King Charles. I nearly called him Prince Charles. I'm not used to calling him king yet.
Oh, my God.
Because of the ears. It's because of the ears, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the ears. Kind of the nose.
Yeah, it's a very distinctive face. I think it's a better depiction than the official one we have, but I wanted to be consistent with 19th century portraits, but this one is a close runner-up.
Wow, he is really, like, thick. His arms.
Mm. He's also wearing 16th century armor, and he's got a page boy next to him. Fixing up his armor. And we have some statues as well. Loads of statues. Most famous ones there's one outside Sacré-Cœur in Paris. But I'll show you the most famous one, which is in the city of St. Louis, Missouri. It was the most iconic image of the city until the building of the big arch that's in St. Louis. St. Louis? And it's got him, it's got the iconic him holding up his sword, more like a cross than a sword.
holding it by the blade, asking for your hand to be cut.
Yeah. Shows how metal he was.
Damn, look at that horse, though.
Yeah.
That horse is like,
But yeah, this statue has actually been the source of controversy in recent years because of Louis' reputation as a very anti-Semitic ruler. Which we're going to get to in Vallejo. Also, it's kind of a white supremacist symbol in a city that doesn't really like that or used to like it a bit too much, I guess. Yeah. So that's that. We've also got some shiny reliquaries that were constructed during his reign. There's one that's constructed to house the Crown of Thorns, which I'll show you here. It's very fancy looking. And
I can't even bloody see the crown.
Yeah, I think it's probably disintegrated, actually. And we've got Sainte-Chapelle, which is a great monument to his reign.
Have you got a picture of his jawbone?
You can definitely find it online, but it just looks like a jawbone.
I'm Googling it.
I don't know what we would glean from looking at the jawbone on this audio medium. But yeah, so everyone go on the WordPress, look at all these images. There's like 15 of them. There's a lot. Because this is from me narrowing it down, because there's so many depictions in art of St. Louis, more arguably than Charlemagne. So with that in mind, what do we want to give for Enchanté?
I'm going to have to give him a high score.
Yeah.
Like, come on, he's a saint.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to give him a fair few points. Loves his crusades.
Crusades.
That's pretty
cool,
ring.
As bad as crusades are, they are good for the medieval kingly image.
Yeah, and he lives up to that image. He has a city named after him.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's as good as Charlemagne and Eleanor of Aquitaine, who both got 10 out of 10 from you?
No, but I'd say it's more like an 8 or a 9.
See, I was gonna go a full 10 because I think it's the same.
I don't know. There's just something that I'm just missing.
Something you're missing? Okay. I think it's got to be a 10. He's got the architecture. He's got the symbols. True. He's got the depictions throughout time. He's got depictions in every era.
True. Okay, I'll go for 10.
Ooh, very good, Louis. So that is a 20 out of 20 for Entente. He's up in the top spot with Charlemagne. So let us see if he can get as perfect a score in En Garde.
En Garde.
Early Reign with Blanche, in tandem with Blanche, yeah. Basically. This was a masterclass in increasing royal authority.
Yes.
Blanche repelled the initial threats, and then Louis followed that up with the Saintonge War, which was a great success. And then after that, Louis had a sort of peaceful stance towards England, to the extent that his former enemies actually joined him on the crusade. Good stuff there. He was accused at certain points of being too lenient towards the English. He allowed Henry III, at one point a bit later in his reign, to increase the size of Gascony, the English duchy. But this was land that Louis had kind of taken during the Saintonge War, that he thought maybe that belongs back with England. And in return, he got Henry III to swear homage, which he hadn't been able to. Done before.
And that was a good.
Yeah. So ultimately, England is still paying homage for those lands. They are still part of France.
For now.
However, the Crusades are kind of the Achilles heel for Louis when it comes to En Garde, because.
Yeah.
They were a great show of force, but they ultimately failed and they eroded his authority within France because he was away for so long. And he was also draining the treasury, because remember, Blanche was having to send huge wads of cash, particularly when Louis and his brothers got captured. And then there was that 800,000 bezant ransom, which was about...
I thought that wasn't actually given.
Half of it was given, which was still, you know, 400,000. That's still a lot. Still huge. Yeah.
True.
So you can imagine how annoyed Blanche was when a letter arrived from Margaret being like, we need lots of money. That kind of been good for mother-daughter-in-law relations.
If I had gone, none of this would have happened.
Yeah. The height of Louis's rule was probably his early majority, when he was winning the Saintonge War, and he was this young, gallant prince that everyone wanted to follow.
Should never have listened to his brother.
Great victory at the Battle of Taillebourg, and then a great display of chivalry towards Hugh de Lusignan when he surrenders. Louis also is the first king of France to control land on the Mediterranean coast, to like directly control it. Because he ends up getting the region we used to call Septimania from the County of Toulouse.
Mm. I wish we still called it Septimania. It's such a fun name.
Yeah. We now call it the French Riviera. That's what we call it.
Yeah, that doesn't sound as fun.
Sounds pretty fun to me. Saint-Tropez. This is where Louis built Aigues-Mortes, his big urban project, his big port.
He
severely deforested the territory around it as a result, to the extent that locals were struggling to find fuel for the winter. But maybe that's a slight negative in flavor. But yeah, Louis's youth, definitely the high point of his reign. He also was very cautious when it came to doing that muddy dispute between the Pope and the Emperor. He was like, I'm not going to get directly involved. I'm going to instead focus on bringing Christians together. There's also a nearby threat that we're going to have to start keeping an eye on called Aragon, which is now under the Catalan House of Barcelona, and it's become a rising power in the Western Mediterranean. So they're going to be in conflict with France a bit over those waters. But Louis resolves this, at least temporarily, by marrying his son, Philip III, to their princess, Isabella of Aragon, who becomes the mother of subsequent kings. So that's... Got a marriage alliance there.
Yeah.
We'll see how Philip manages to screw it up next episode. but yeah, Crusades, less favorable. Both of them fail. Between the Crusades, though, is another good stable period for Louis. He shows his ability to rule without Blanche as a guiding light.
Yeah. How long was between the Crusades? How many years?
13 years. And he also proved to be very good at settling disputes within his land among his vassals.
That's good.
Between the Crusades, Louis was very good at revitalizing France's economy, making it strong.
Oh, that's good.
A lot of this came at the expense of a particular group of people.
Jewish.
Yeah, which we'll get into in later. But it was good for Louis. Another way that Louis increased his power and authority was through the relics as well, through gathering up those relics, building Saint-Chapelle, making it a beacon for his reign.
True.
So that's all of the En Garde stuff. And of course, let's also consider all of the battley stuff that we heard about in the biography as well, which was a lot of Louis personally leading armies, even though his success rate was about 50-50 overall in terms of if you include all the crusade stuff.
Yeah.
But in France itself, his record is quite positive.
Yeah.
His scorecard is quite high. So what do we want to give for En Garde?
Can't be too high. Crusades really, you know, pulls him down.
He does. Mm. The Royal Domain is now at its height.
Okay.
Because he's got that land way in the south. He's got the Blois lands. He's got
kind of Jerusalem.
Loads of territory. His three brothers are ruling almost the rest of France, with the exception of Flanders and Brittany.
True.
And Burgundy as well. But that's still Capetian. True. So it's a big royal domain.
True. Since this section is more about him than about people.
Yeah, we'll get into how Louis was as a people person in Voulez-Vous. It's going to be a long Voulez-Vous round.
I don't know, I'm kind of thinking like a 7. Maybe a bit lower, maybe a 6. I'm going to go 6.
6.
Just the Crusades. Come on, man.
Yeah.
Can't even bloody
win. I think I'll do a 7. Because at least it's good battle experience, maybe. But a lot of it
doesn't help.
A lot of it is Blanche, who got 9.5. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is Blanche, especially the early gains.
It is. Yep.
Ooh. Okay, I'll join you at 6. Let's be harsh. Okay. Let's be mean. I'll join you at 6. So that is a 12 for En Garde. Still above 10. So let's go to Voulez-Vous.
Voulez-Vous?
I'll say this out the gate. If you're going to live anywhere in the 13th century, France was a pretty good option. It's the largest, most prosperous kingdom in Europe at this time. And this era is later known as the Golden Century of Saint Louis to posterity.
Damn.
Louis himself, as we've said, began as this very gallant, chivalrous figure. He was already quite humble and pious even before the Crusade kind of changed him a bit. But yeah, the failure of the Crusade saw a big shift in his behavior as he went down the monk king pipeline. Right. So after he returned from the Seventh Crusade, gone were the merry days of hunting and jousting and feasting.
Aww.
Yeah. So his chaplain, Geoffrey de Beaulieu, writes that, quote, returning to France after various dangers of sea and land, the glorious pilgrim was received with immense joy and solemn processions wherever he went, as was fitting. But this true lover of humility declined all these things as far as he could. Thus, when he was received with such honorific rituals on the day he entered Paris, he was displeased by the many honors of immense and superfluous expense which he saw. And for this reason, in order to flee and diminish the follies and sumptuous splendors and vanities of this sort that he knew were being prepared for that evening throughout the streets of Paris, to the wonder of many, after he had dined, he left the city and spent that night at his manor in Vincennes, which stood a full league apart from the city. So he runs in, he comes back to Paris, everyone's like, "Where, you're back?" And he's like, "Leave me alone."
He's like, I'm a changed person now.
Goes off to his little country house.
To sulk.
So yeah, Louis's court suddenly became a far colder, sulkier place.
Aww. So it's like after Charlemagne died and then, you know.
It's a bit Louis the Pious, especially since.
I know, that's what I was thinking.
Louis the Ninth saw it as his duty, kind of like Louis the Pious, to repent for all of the sins of his kingdom, which he believed had caused the failure of the Crusade, instead of, you know, bad tactics. Bad advisors. But this could be seen in a good light as well, because he's cutting down on the expenses of the court and he's funneling those into.
Well, to make up for all expenses he wasted on the Crusade. Yeah,
partly that, but also he's funneling it into better investments. Joinville writes that never once in my life did I hear him order any dish for his table, as many rich men do. He was content to eat what his cook prepared for him and what was set before him. So he's not very picky about his food. And even before the crusade, Joinville tells us...
He just loved his fish.
Yeah. Joinville tells us that Louis dressed quite humbly. He wore simple dark blues and browns. And instead of like bright, sumptuous colors and like furs and stuff, like he didn't like any of that. So even as a young man, he resembled an old man in his dress. Yeah.
An old soul.
He's a bit of a fuddy-duddy. Yeah. He also washed the hands and feet of poor men every Saturday. And at the end of it, he gave their hands and feet a little kiss. Yeah. And he was very big on the whole touching people to cure scrofula thing. In fact,
too bad that touching couldn't cure him.
Yeah, well, yeah. he didn't believe in touching himself. That was wrong. many miracles were attributed to the king's touch, which was part of the campaign to make him a saint. They were like, oh, there were 37 miracles on this day because the king touched these people. Yeah. So yeah, he might seem a bit stuck up and sanctimonious at times, but he was very comfortable around commoners. He loved regaling them with stories of the Crusades. And Joinville writes that he used to gather a bunch of men around him, like, away from all of his, you know, pomp and ceremony. And they'd just sit under a tree together and he'd tell them stories. As long as you were happy to hear Louis's endless stories about anecdotes from the Crusades that he told on and on over and over again.
He's like, we can never mention that servant though.
Oh, that servant. Yeah. He obviously doesn't mention them because we get that account from the Arab Chroniclers.
He was that disgusted by that servant. He's like, I can never mention him again. Oh.
Yeah. So as we said, rather than extravagant feasts and fashions, Louis prefers to use his money for things like scholarship. He sponsored a massive royal library of theological texts, which was influenced by the libraries of the Eastern Sultans. Yeah. He also sponsored a lot of charitable monastic groups. For example, he oversaw the foundation of the Trinitarian Order, which raised funds to ransom Christians who had been taken captive in the Mediterranean, either on crusade or by pirates. So that was a good cause, I guess. However, of course, we do get the rather self-harming, fanatical side of the religiousness. He even took to wearing a hair shirt occasionally and having monks with him to do penance. Ugh. Very Louis the Pious-esque there.
Yeah.
And he also put penance on the kingdom, wanted the kingdom to repent. This did manifest in some good ways. He purged his administration of corrupt officials.
Oh, that's good.
He mutilated and executed a bunch of officials for corruption. He made some good legal reforms. He introduced the presumption of innocence, as we said last episode with Blanche, which is, you know, innocent before proven guilty, that whole thing.
Yeah, that's nice.
He used humiliation rituals to punish wrongdoers of all kinds, and he forbade blasphemous speech. So if you got caught speaking heresy, your lips or tongue were cut off.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What's humiliation methods? I want to know what those
This are. Is like putting people in the stocks, throwing tomatoes at them. Not tomatoes because they didn't have tomatoes, but, you know, throwing rotten fruit at them.
Onions? Do they have onions?
An onion would hurt if you got pelted with an onion. Cabbages. My cabbages. So, the Inquisition, the people nobody expects, were at the forefront of a lot of these stuff that Louis was doing. He was giving them a lot of power, including giving them the power to stamp out the Cathars in the south. But, of course, the group that received the brunt of Louis's ire are, of course,
the Jews. It's always the Jewish.
Early in his personal rule in 1240, Louis reversed his mother Blanche's sympathetic stance towards the Jews, and he started the Disputations of Paris, which was when a Jewish convert named Nicholas Donat alerted Louis to the fact that the Talmud, the primary source for all Jewish laws, contained 35 articles that he deemed anti-Christian. So in reaction to this, Louis secured Pope Gregory the Ninth's support in burning 12,000 copies of the Talmud.
I thought you were going to say burning 12,000 people.
Well, people did get burned as well if you spoke out against this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So Jewish people in France lived under more intense scrutiny than ever. They were forbidden from chanting loud enough for Christians to hear in their services. And they were forbidden from constructing new synagogues so that the faith couldn't spread. And they had to wear special badges to mark them out as Jews. This is where we get the start of that. Yes.
Oh, good.
The outlawing of the Talmud was later reversed by a subsequent pope, but the damage was kind of done. And, you know, Louis earned a lot of his crusading money, as we said, by imposing harsh penalties on moneylenders, many of which were Jews. Although a lot of them at this point were also Lombard bankers from northern Italy, who were becoming increasingly powerful at this time. And we'll see the French start to lean on them more than the Jews as they kind of drive the Jews out. So that's cheerful. Ending on that note, what do we want to give for Wooly Boo?
It's really going to dampen that.
We do have a lot of the, like, great cultural stuff that happens, particularly at the start of his reign, but a lot of that is Blanche. We gave Blanche credit for a lot of that.
Yeah.
We do have some legal reforms that are good, but we also have some bad ones. Not so nice ones.
Feels like he has to have a middling score. He loses points for just being not so nice to the Jews.
Yeah. It is still the golden age. But not if you're Jewish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Cathar. Or Muslim.
Yeah. Anyone who isn't Christian, basically.
Well, anyone who isn't Catholic, because the Cathars are Christians.
Oh, right.
Yeah, just the wrong sort of Christian.
I think like a five or six.
Maybe like a 5.5.
Yeah.
I think I want to give. Because it's not. Okay,
go five.
It's kind of not making things worse, except for certain groups of people. But a lot of it is momentum that was started by Blanche.
Not the Jewish part.
Yeah, well, with the exception of that, I mean, like, you know, the golden agey stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to go five.
Five?
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to do 5.5.
I'm going to stick with five.
Okay. All right, so that is a 10.5 for Wooly Boo. Not as good. His scores are declining as we go on. And I think they're going to decline even more because the next round is Ooh La La.
Ooh la la.
Okay, he gets points in captured, though.
Do you think that's scandalous? Do you think that requires points?
Yes, he's the first one to get captured.
I would think we shouldn't give him points for that because it's bad and not really it's not really scandal, is it? That's just a thing that happens in war if you lose a battle. If anything, he should lose points for that because it's bad on guard.
Yeah, that's on guard.
I'm not giving him any little points for it.
Even though I totally want to give him a point for what he said about that servant because it made me laugh.
Okay, sure. Yeah, let's do it for that. But let's get into his sex life because that's what we want to hear about in Ooh La La. So Louis seems to have had a healthy libido, unlike his pious predecessor, Louis VII, who got a bit carried away with the whole chastity thing. Thank God he had the super sperm to make up for that.
What do you mean his predecessor number seven?
Louis VII was very chaste.
But what about Louis VIII?
Louis VIII was less chaste.
Yeah, shouldn't his predecessor be Louis VIII?
No, predecessor means anyone before him.
Yeah, and the VIII was before him.
He was his immediate predecessor, but Louis VII is also his predecessor.
The general one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Bit of a terminology thing there. Yeah. But yeah, Louis did have certain times of year where he was like, I'm not having sex, like Advent, Lent, and major feast days. So Blanche had to sleep alone those nights.
Blanche?
Not Blanche. Margaret had to sleep alone.
Yeah, it's not finding interest.
I don't know, Blanche was a bit, Blanche had a bit of a, Louis had a bit of a Oedipus complex, I think.
Not that much, though.
But Louis and Margaret did have a few saucy sort of shenanigans at the start of their reign when they were forbidden to be together. If you remember, Blanche only allowed them to do, like, official lying in bed together. They weren't allowed to meet each other outside that. So their favourite palace was the Palace of Pontoise, where, unknown to Blanche, the king's quarters were above the queen's quarters and they were connected by a secret spiral staircase.
Oh!
So they shacked up there together and they used to, like, secretly visit each other. And Blanche was staying in, like, the other room. And she, when she was coming down the hall, the servants would, like, do a special knock on the door to let the couple, to let Margaret know that she had to, go back down the stairs. Yeah.
Oh my God, I love that!
So that's a great little story.
That is.
But yeah, their relationship was quite complicated. Another thing that's probably, this might have to go back in voulez-vous, but Louis was a pretty good family man. He, in spite of the uppy-downy relationship with Margaret, he took great joy in his children. He took an active role in educating them, just like his mother had, training his sons in the ways of war, making sure his daughters could read, that sort of thing.
That's nice. Can imagine him being the type of dad to read the stories before bed.
Yeah.
Or telling the stories before bed.
When he knighted his son, Philip, in 1267, he put a temporary cease on the austerity of the court, and he threw an extravagant party for Philip.
Oh.
So that was quite nice.
It's like, I'll break the rules for you, son.
Yeah. By the way, the knighting of princes seems to have replaced the ritual of making them junior kings. That seems to be like... There seems to have been like a bit of a switch over with that. We still don't have Dauphins yet. The heir is not called the Dauphin until about 100 years after this.
Soon though.
Soon.
Like saying Dauphin.
And Louis also, this is really cute, he sent for his children every night before he went to bed. And Joinville writes that he, quote, would tell them of the good deeds of kings and emperors, at the same time pointing out that they should take such men as an example. He would also tell them of the deeds of wicked princes, who by their dissolute lives, their rapacity, and their avarice have brought ruin on their kingdoms. Yeah, he'd tell them a lot of stories about how bad John was.
Yeah, that was his, like, go-to, was John. He was like, oh, that John.
At the end of his life, he writes a long letter to his son Philip III called Les Enseignements, which outline his duties as a king and the guidelines that he should follow. I won't read the whole thing because it's very long, but...
Yeah. That's really nice to give them a manual.
It highlights justice as the key virtue that a king should always strive for.
Well, yeah. King should be just.
So that's maybe, if we want to go back and give him another point for voulez-vous, I think that stuff is great. But we're in all the law now. I don't know if you want to go back.
That's not scandalous for...
But I missed that stuff in voulez-vous, and maybe we want to give him an extra little point for it. I don't know.
No.
I don't know about you.
I'm not changing it.
Okay, I think I'm going back. I'm changing my voulez-vous score because I forgot about that stuff. So I'm bumping him up to 6. So that's
voulez-vous.
11 for voulez-vous. Going back to ooh-la-la.
Ooh-la-la.
Louis's not a saucy fellow.
Yeah.
Can we give him points for being a religious persecutor? Which is scandalous for us.
Oh, I was going to say, you can't even, like, give him points for, like, having the secret staircase to his wife because he should be allowed to be with his wife.
I still think that's a fun story, though.
Yeah, I'll give him a point for that, though.
This is where we give points for fun stories.
Yeah. And I'm going to give a point for the servant because that
just for that one thing. Yeah, I don't know. Overall,
that's like melodramatic and it's like highest.
There is also the family drama with him and Margaret. If you remember, at one point last episode, Louis betrays Margaret and makes her swear obedience to him in favor of his mother. Margaret is always annoyed that he's
Mummy's boy.
Mummy's boy. And also there's the abandoning her at Damietta and the whole drama around her giving birth while having to negotiate his release.
His release, yeah.
Just the family drama is quite juicy and I like it.
It is.
So I think I'm going to give him like a 3 or 4. 3 maybe.
Yeah, I was thinking a 3.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do 3. So that is a 6 for Ulala. Now let's get into Lovey on Throne. Any predictions?
Long?
Lots of children.
I don't know how many bubs. So
let's get into it.
Lovey on Throne.
Louis reigned from his father's death on the 8th of November, 1226, until his own death on the 25th of August, 1270. And the 25th of August is thus his feast day as a saint. By the way, it's also the day that he set out on his seventh crusade. So significant, doubly significant. So that's 43 years, 9 months and 17 days, which is our third longest reign so far. So he beat Philip II and Louis VII, but he's behind Charlemagne and Philip I, who Philip I is still our longest reign. So that's 8.2 points. And let's get to the children. Louis's personal chaplain, Beaulieu, tells us that he desired for at least two of his sons and his eldest daughter to enter the church. But it didn't end up happening because he needed them for marriage alliances. So all these children are with Margaret of Provence. He obviously didn't have illegitimate children. That was not in his character.
He didn't have issues there.
I'm going to do these in batches. So we've got the first batch, which is from before he goes on crusade. This is Blanche, who dies in infancy. Isabella, who marries King Tybalt II of Navarre, the son of Tybalt from last episode. And we've got Louis, who marries Berengaria of Castile, but sadly dies childless in 1255. So he doesn't outlive his father. Isabella did, though. Isabella outlives him by 6 months.
Oh, yeah. Still 6 months.
Yeah. And then we've got fourth child, Philip III, who succeeds as King of France and is thus next episode's subject. Then we've got John, who dies in infancy. And those are the first five children.
That was really vile. You're like, John!
John, who dies in infancy. Then Louis and Margaret go on crusade and we get John Tristan, born in Damietta.
He dies. Just before his dad.
Dies just before his dad. That. He was the Count of Valois.
Like 2 weeks.
And he was childless as well. Then we've got Peter, born in Palestine, who was given the Norman counties of Perche and Alençon, got married, but none of his children survived infancy. So, that's gone. And then we've got Blanche, also born in Palestine, married the Castilian Infante, Ferdinand de la Cerda, who was meant to be king of Spain, but he died when he was 20, and his children were actually disinherited in favor of his brother, Sancho IV. So her children didn't end up getting to be kings of Spain, which kind of sucks for her. Then we've got post-crusade children after they get home. We've got Margaret Jr., who married John I, Duke of Brabant, but died a childless teenager, though she managed to outlive her father by a year.
Well, that's so sad she died as a teenager.
Then we've got Robert, Count of Clermont, whose descendants will eventually become the House of Bourbon. Don't know if you've heard of them. So keep an eye out for them 300 years in the future. But they're going to continue in the background. So, Robert outlives Louis. And then we've got the youngest daughter, who also outlives, called Agnes, who was the became the Duchess of Burgundy by marrying Duke Robert II and had 8 kids with him. So that's nice for her.
Yeah.
So Margaret of Provence gave birth to Agnes when she was 39. And her first child was when she was 19. So that's 20 years of children.
Ugh.
So that's 11 children overall, but how many survived? How many?
7?
Yes, 7. It's gotta be of the same number. Which gives Louis 11.8 points for the children. So that's 8.2 plus 11.8, which is, what is that, Eliza?
8.2 plus 11.8.
8,
well, 20.
Yeah. Which means...
Oh, exactly on.
Which means... What does that mean? If it's a 20 out of...
Perfect. I thought it was out of 40. Out of 20. Perfect score, sorry.
Yeah, so he's got the highest Beyond Throne score out of any king ever.
Wow.
Yeah. Because he's just got that perfect balance of lots of kids, long reign.
That survived.
Yeah.
Well, just survived and then died shortly after him.
Yeah. It's not the longest reign and it's not the most children, but it's the perfect balance that gives you the
combo.
Full
damn
perfect,
the perfect score amount, 20.
Yeah.
that's
nice. And it's his Beyond Throne score that all of the other ones are based on.
Oh.
Because the calculation means that he has to get 20 because of... I can't explain it just because I don't do
maths. I don't worry about it.
And you don't have to worry about it. But yeah, highest Beyond Throne score ever. So let's tally up the scores. Shall we?
Dling.
Ooh. St. Louis isn't going to be happy about this score. Because this score...
50?
The score is exactly 69. Oh, that's so ironic.
No, because I feel that he was probably very vanilla in bed.
I don't know. They had a lot of kids. He kept that spark going for 20 years.
But, I know, but was it like, did they have the, like, you know, was there a different position? That's the question. And for all we know, he could have only had done it 11 times.
Yeah, I get the feeling he was a strictly procreation based sex haver, based on the fact that there are no
mistresses. In and out, vanilla.
In and out, literally. Down the stairs, up the stairs.
Lukewarm water, as they say.
Ew.
Okay, no. Because I mean, like, he's too exciting for, like, some of the, like, sometimes I'm like, that some people are too exciting to be vanilla. They're more like lukewarm water.
Okay. That could be your own thing. So, with that said, is he fascinating enough, entertaining enough, majestic and fabulous and irresistible enough to be released from our dungeon, to go through the battle of our championship, and to be spared the guillotine?
I don't know.
Ooh, don't know.
Why? What are you going for?
I don't know. I want to know where you want to go for. This is really one of the ones I've been tossing up. Of like...
Like, he, on the one hand, like, he is the saint, a saint and all that, and I was like pretty impressed. But it's like, your crusades were epic fails, man.
They were just bad. The one thing that's like his main thing that he wants to be known for, he fails at.
He did badly!
Yeah. When he should have been focusing on making France great, which he did to an extent. The majority of his reign was spent in France doing that good stuff, but Crusades kind of bring it down a bit, don't they?
Yeah, cast a shadow.
To be fair, Philip Augustus also went on a failed crusade. Yeah, and he got spared. But then we have Louis VII, who went on a failed crusade, got guillotined.
True.
So, don't know.
That's because I feel like
St. Louis is kind of in the middle of them. But which side does he fall on?
Oh gosh, is this
does
hard?
He fall on the side that puts his neck under the guillotine? Or the side where he's safe? Decisions. Do you think we have to coin flip it?
I think we might.
I think this level of uncertainty might call for a coin flip. And that's going to make people angry. But we didn't start this podcast to be vanilla and uncontroversial, did we?
No.
We want to be provocative.
Yeah.
Do you want to get...
Should I grab a coin?
Do you want to get a yen out?
Do we want to go to the big 500? That's gold and it's got some nice leaf on it. Or do you want to go the smaller cherry blossom one? Cherry blossom or maple leaf?
Let's do cherry blossom.
Okay, that's 100 yen.
The more Japanese one.
Okay,
so wait.
Oh, right. Forgot.
Cherry blossom is spare. 100 is guillotine.
Dead, yeah.
Yeah.
$100.
Oh! Oh, wow.
I can do that again, though, because it kind of got interfered.
No, it's done.
Stick on that one toss.
You did it. You killed him. Okay. He's dead.
Okay.
You can't.
He's dead.
You can't sew his head back on. Bring him back. Can't bring him back.
True.
Wow.
The end decides. We cannot
people are gonna
say
be,
no to the end.
People are going to be mad at us. But you know...
Blame the yen.
Look, he's St. Louis, but is he a saint for a good reason?
Yeah. Can't even do a crusade successfully.
Can't do a crusade successfully. Tried twice. Second time, just basically went off to die.
And again, does anyone do a successful crusade? I feel like if there was a successful crusade, then there wouldn't need to be another crusade.
I mean, technically the first crusade was a success. It's just that things kind of faltered after that, hence need for second crusade. And then second crusade went even worse. So then they needed the third crusade. Third crusade went not quite as badly, but still badly, etc., etc., etc. But don't worry, we're going to have a ninth and tenth crusade at some point. They're not going to learn very quickly. But yeah, we are at the stage where the fad for crusade is starting to go down a little bit. So that is Louis IX. Let us know what you all thought. Let us know how mad the Catholics in the audience are for us killing their saint. Lastly, we want to thank our lovely patrons, of course. We've got some new patrons.
Yes.
We, of course, have Eliza's grandmother, who is a new nosebleed section.
Thank you, Nonnie. That's what I call my grandma.
Yeah. Other new nosebleed sections, we've got Eric of the Ranking 76 podcast, who we recently did a collab with. Another collab.
So check that out if you haven't listened.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. We play Pictionary. It's fun. You can see us try to
and
draw.
I'm just playing out weird and as usual.
Eliza's weird as usual. And other nosebleed section, we have Michelle, who has a gorgeous big dog in her picture. So thank you, Michelle.
Aww.
And Economy Plus tier, we have two new patrons. We've got Bottom Dollar.
Yay.
Let's hope that Bottom Dollar didn't spend their bottom dollar on this because there are more important things in life.
Maybe they're just a really big fan of Annie.
Oh, betcha bottom dollar. Yeah, yeah. And then we've got Mitchell. Thank you, Mitchell, for also being in the Economy Plus tier. And as ever, thank you to our VIP box patrons, Courtney, Adrian, and Roberto, the Holy Trinity.
Yes.
Thank you to you. Also, next episode, we're going to read reviews of the podcast. So get in your Apple Podcast reviews. Also, Louise Brimican, one of our patrons, said that there's now reviews on Podcast Addict, which is what I listen to podcasts on. And you can also leave ratings on Spotify. So do all those. A good way of supporting the podcast without giving monies. For zero monies.
Zero money.
Yeah. No ransom money required. So that's going to be au revoir from me.
And stay of horses from me.